Good evening, everybody. It's my pleasure to welcome you here all this evening and to welcome our distinguished speaker, Nikki Lacey, giving her inaugural lecture following her appointment as Professor of Criminal Law at the LSE. I'm very pleased indeed we were to get her to come here. Nikki was previously Fellow in Law at New College, Oxford from 1984 to 95 and Professor of Law at Birkbeck College from 1995 to 97. She works in the fields of criminal law, criminal justice, and legal and social theory. The author of innumerable articles, at least that's what it says here, and 6 books. Her most recent book was entitled Unspeakable Subjects, and she was just telling me that she was on Start the Week speaking about unspeakable subjects. This lecture, the subject of this lecture this evening. She's also written many essays on legal and social theory with a significant feminist perspective to them. She recently gave one of the founding e-lectures for BoxMind.com, an interactive online lecture site launched on 5th of March 2001, a rival for LSE's own UNext.com, should be said. She's currently working on a biography of the legal philosopher H.L.A. Hart, and on the historical development of ideas of responsibility for crime in Britain, which I believe forms the subject of this lecture here tonight. The title of her lecture is Mapping the Subject of Criminal Law, History, Philosophy, and Criminal Responsibility. Please give her a very, very warm welcome.
Can everybody hear me all right? Yeah? Great. Well, I'd like to begin by thanking all of you for being here, and you, Tony, for agreeing to chair the lecture. I don't suppose it's exactly how you dreamed of spending the last moments of your sabbatical, but I'm really touched that you did, and not least because coming to work with you was one of the things that made me want to come to LSE. It's also, of course, an incredibly special thing for me to be standing here addressing so many people who have survived, so far at least, the experience of being my family, friends, students, teachers, and colleagues, and to many of whom I owe much, much more than can be acknowledged on this occasion. I must say that 3 years after taking up my chair here, I didn't really expect to be giving an inaugural lecture. It came as a surprise to some of my law department colleagues, too. Let me just share with you the reaction of a couple of my dearest colleagues. Don't worry, guys, we're not going to have any naming and shaming. The first suggested that giving an inaugural at this stage was at the bounds of propriety. Now, in case you think this is a hostile comment, let me just explain that this colleague knows that I'm perfectly comfortable in that particular space. A second responded that it would nonetheless be a good occasion for the department, which needed more bread and circuses. Now, I'm not an expert in ancient history, but I have to admit this did make me feel a little bit nervous. But you look quite benign. You look quite benign. So, inaugural lectures are occasions which at once invite a certain degree of autobiography and provide the occasion for celebrating an institution. By way of fulfilling both of these pleasant obligations, let me start by just saying a word about my personal journey to LSE. I'm afraid it's not a story of particularly effective ambition. I first conceived the desire to come here when I was at school. Unfortunately, my school regarded London in general, and the LSE in particular, as dens of vice. Well, that sounded pretty good to me. But even more unfortunately, in those days, I wasn't quite bolshy enough to stand up to such opposition. I was, however, lucky enough to find my way to UCL, to University College, whose classical portico soothed my teacher's anxieties and whose radical traditions satisfied my idea of what it meant to go to university. As a result of the encouragement of a few exceptionally generous teachers at UCL, my next move, instead of being rationally south towards Aldwych, was in fact west towards Oxford. And so began a 15-year period of shuttling back and up and down the M40, enjoying the many intellectual and aesthetic privileges of Oxford, but I have to admit, never really happy being away from London. In 1995, I finally settled at the metropolitan end of the motorway. I took up a chair at another very special institution, Birkbeck College, where I enjoyed some wonderful colleagues and students. The lure of my long-standing dream of coming to LSE was, however, irresistible. It's the only time in my life that it's taken me 25 years to do what I wanted. Long-deferred desires, when finally fulfilled, are often said to result in disappointment. Happily, after 3 years, I'm in a position to report that this is far from the case. 3 years into my job here, my love affair with LSE is still in full swing. Though on some days I do wonder why, it represents the essence of everything I enjoy about both London and academic life. Coming here has felt quite simply like coming home, and not only because of Michael Zander's very touching gesture of greeting me as I unpacked my city-begrimed books with a cup of coffee and a pair of rubber gloves. It's true. I mean, even I couldn't make up something like that. For any legal academic whose research has a social science orientation, LSE really is an extraordinary place to work. And for me personally, it has not only the attractions of an incomparable law department with a marvellous tradition of interdisciplinary, theoretically path-breaking and policy-relevant work, but also a marvellous group of people interested in social theory and in criminal justice across a number of departments. Having not yet grown up enough to distance the negative associations of the word, I haven't entirely acquired that ultimate badge of identification, the practice of referring to LSE as the school. I've got a nasty feeling I may do so before long. Actually, it's worse than that. I realise as I utter those words that I did so in the academic board, but it was under great strain. So, to the lecture itself, the responsible subject to criminal law. Perhaps the fact that this lecture is about responsibility means I'm growing up after all, or perhaps not. My personal theory of academic life is that we all tend to work on what we find most difficult. As my title suggests, the project I'm working on has both substantive and methodological aspects. Substantively, I've got two purposes. First, I'm studying the way in which English criminal law's conception of responsibility, its very conception of what it is to be a subject of criminal law, has changed since the 18th century. Second, I'm exploring the relationship between these changes in legal framework and the broader social, political, cultural, and economic changes. Methodologically, I'm engaging in a debate in legal philosophy, or legal theory, I should say. In other words, how do the disciplinary resources of philosophy, history, and the social sciences contribute to our understanding of law? In this lecture, I'm going to introduce both of these concerns to you in the following way. First, I'll give a brief sketch of the rather peculiar field, let's call it Anglo-American criminal law theory, in which I'm working. Secondly, I'll set out what I see as the main problems in the field. And thirdly, this will be the main part of the lecture, I'll tell you about the project in which I'm currently engaged, summarising my research so far and setting out a couple of the theories in the field and sketching, finally, the main hypotheses I'm working with. As intelligent people, at least some of whom have avoided the peculiar experience of legal education, you probably assume that theorists of criminal law engage in debates about the substance of criminal law in different systems. What kinds of things are or should be criminalised, what interests or values criminal law seeks to express. In fact, with a few exceptions, criminal law theorists in Britain and America today, they're as often philosophers as lawyers, by the way, are strikingly uninterested in those substantive questions. Indeed, they're generally quite happy to leave questions about the content of criminal law to sociologists on the one hand and moral and political philosophers on the other. What really interests them is rather the form of criminal law, in other words, the conceptual building blocks out of which legal doctrine constructs criminal liability. This conceptual framework is often understood in terms of a Latin maxim, actus non facit reum nisi mens sit rea, an act doesn't make for guilt unless the mind is guilty. The maxim is generally agreed to be both inelegant Latin and a seriously misleading statement of law. Victorian jurist James Fitzjames Stephen famously described it as not so much a maxim as a minim. But lawyers, being conservative people and not a little inclined to bemuse non-lawyers, even if they have to resort to Latin to do so, the maxim has nonetheless survived, more or less intact, as a central feature of both academic and judicial thinking in the common law world. A more accurate statement would be that the general conditions for criminal liability include both a conduct element, causing death in the case of homicide, and a mental or fault element, intending to kill. So even if a statutory provision doesn't include a specific mens rea word, such as intent, judges, so the story goes, will generally read such a word into the provision. Moreover, even if the conduct and fault elements are satisfied, it may be that a defence removes liability. In cases, for example, where the defendant was defending herself against attack, or was under duress, or was suffering from some serious form of mental incapacity. This three-tiered structure, conduct, responsibility or fault, and defence, is the basis of what is now known as the general part of criminal law. At one level, it's simply an analytic framework. It purports to describe the structure of criminal liability. But this isn't the only reason why it interests criminal law theorists. For implicit in most discussions of this Latin maxim is a strong normative thesis about the legitimacy of criminal law. Along with the much vaunted presumption of innocence and the principle of legality, the idea that criminal liability must involve both conduct and responsibility lies at the heart of contemporary criminal law's idea of itself as not just a system of state power, but also as a legitimate, in some senses even a moral system. Most obviously, in contemporary discussions in Britain and North America, the maxim connects with a cluster of values associated with political liberalism. For example, the principle that criminal liability generally requires a positive act rather than merely an omission, in contrast, by the way, to several of the systems of the continent of Europe, this is premised on a sort of libertarian idea that it's less intrusive for the state to prohibit conduct than positively to require it. Similarly, the idea that one can only be liable for an action for which one is responsible connects with fundamental ideas of fairness and respect for individual liberty. In fact, criminal law theorists today are primarily interested not so much in the conduct as in the responsibility condition, what I'll call from now on the principle of responsibility. So, how is this fundamental idea of responsibility conceived? The dominant argument, encapsulated in the work of the jurist H.L.A. Hart, is that individuals' criminal responsibility is based on their capacities of cognition or understanding. It's only fair to punish somebody who can understand what they're doing. And capacities of volition or will. It's only fair to punish someone who has the capacity to act otherwise than they did. In philosophical terms, this capacity theory of responsibility assumes either free will or some version of soft determinism. In criminal law, the capacity conception is often interpreted as entailing that the paradigm case of mens rea, or legal responsibility, is a subjective mental state. Obvious examples would be intention, foresight of harm, or knowledge of circumstances. A person accused of murder must intend to kill or cause serious harm. A person accused of rape must know that the person he rapes does not consent. This subjective understanding has recently received resounding endorsement from the House of Lords in the case of B and the DPP, and I think it's likely to be pushed yet further forward by the Human Rights Act. But what about objective versions of fault? For example, negligence in the sense of a failure to reach a reasonable standard of behaviour. These are reluctantly admitted to have some relevance, but are represented in most commentaries as empirically marginal and normatively irregular. on the capacity theory, a fully objective standard is unfair because it fails to investigate whether or not the defendant indeed had the capacity to reach the standard imposed. As for so-called strict liability, liability without fault, it's generally mentioned in hushed tones as an embarrassing and uncivilized exception to the general principles of criminal law. The history of this subjective, capacity-based conception of responsibility and the reasons why it's assumed such a preeminent status are the questions of my research. But my current historical project is premised on questions thrown up by analytic and socio-legal research conducted over the last decade. So I'm going briefly to refer to that work, both to set the scene and to illustrate the methodological question, which is also part of my concern. Starting point for a lot of my research has been the intriguing way in which both judges and commentators almost universally acknowledge the inaccuracies and indeed the obscurity of this little Latin maxim, yet simultaneously assume its importance. Much of my early work was therefore devoted to what we might call an internal critique of criminal law's realization of the maxim. In particular, I focused on the presumption that all or at least the vast majority of offences require proof of a substantial degree of subjective responsibility. For example, if we take what is surely a paradigm case, the crime of murder, we find that the requirement of responsibility falls somewhat short. In English law, a person can be liable for murder even if they intend not death, but a lesser degree of harm. And until as recently as 1957, someone who unintentionally killed while in the course of committing another serious offence could automatically be convicted of murder. That's still the case, by the way, in the USA. Be careful on your holidays. More obviously, in the frequent case of offences where the conduct element is a complex one, having more than one element, the responsibility requirement often stretches only to some parts of the conduct element. A very standard example would be the offence of assault occasioning actual bodily harm, where one can be liable even if one doesn't foresee or intend any actual harm. Furthermore, English criminal law today has many offences which can be committed by negligence or indeed without fault. The offence of manslaughter, which carries a maximum penalty of life imprisonment, can be committed negligently. And a vast array of offences, not only in the so-called regulatory areas of industrial safety or environmental health, but also, for example, in the area of public order, require no proof of mens rea at all. A recent study of all indictable offences found that no fewer than half had an incomplete responsibility requirement, while 40% made some reversal of the presumption of innocence. In this context, my work has been geared to suggesting, to put it very crudely, that the principle of subjective responsibility might reasonably be seen as not so much a logical as an ideological feature of contemporary criminal law. I gradually came to feel, though, that the basis of this method was unduly limited and that one really needed to step outside the boundaries of legal doctrine to throw light on the significance of the fact that the responsibility principle is so extravagantly honoured while being so regularly breached. So in more recent years, I've been drawing on the social sciences and mainly on sociology to further the analysis. The various ways in which one can draw on sociological evidence to shed light on the significance of the responsibility principle. An obvious example would be data on patterns of criminal enforcement, which show that crimes with no fault requirement or a partial fault requirement are empirically dominant. In other words, they're enforced to a greater extent than the other crimes. Research also shows that the distinction between crimes requiring proof of fault and those that don't, which is regarded as absolutely foundational in legal doctrine, is much less clear in practice. Here, pressures on defendants to plead guilty or the limited scope of criminal defences often mean that those convicted of mens rea offences are less than fully responsible. Conversely, funnily enough, enforcement patterns for strict liability crimes suggest that scarce prosecution resources get rationed on fault-based lines. Only those who prosecutors see as responsible are followed up. Another rich sociological theme is the investigation of assumptions which shape the interpretation of the responsibility requirement for different classes of offender. For example, there's persuasive evidence that judges are more likely to accept arguments which question the full mental responsibility of female than of male defendants. In other words, to interpret female offending as mad rather than bad. I wonder, as I say that, whether the fact that many of my students put an apostrophe after the men in mens rea means that they're making a profound feminist point rather than a grammatical mistake. More recently, though, my interest has turned to history, which seems to offer a further purchase on the contemporary significance of the principle of responsibility. What pushed me in a historical direction was my increasing bemusement about a certain style of analysis, which is very common in criminal law theory. The style is strongly associated with analytic philosophy. I hesitate as I say that because I once heard Bernard Williams describe the distinction between continental and analytic philosophy as being a bit like dividing cars up into Japanese and left-hand drive, which I think is a fair point, but I hope you all know roughly what I'm evoking. So this style of analysis, I think, could be caricatured in the following way. The conceptual structure of criminal responsibility consists in volitional and cognitive capacities. Any departure from this conceptual structure entails either logical or moral confusion. An interesting slip from analytic to normative, but not one I can pursue at the moment. Now, to me, that sounds like a metaphysical claim, a claim which doesn't entertain the possibility that particular conceptions of responsibility might have distinctive conditions of existence, economic, social, political, institutional. So one way of scrutinizing that allegedly transcendent claim would be to historicize it seemed to me. Another, of course, would be to study it comparatively. The lack of any strong historical voice in criminal law theory is striking, but it isn't quite complete. There is a weak historical thesis which is quite regularly acknowledged, at least with a nod, by criminal law theorists. It could be called the story of enlightenment or perhaps of modernity. It acknowledges that contemporary ideas of responsibility are strongly associated with a set of values and a set of ideas about human being which emerged in European public consciousness in the 18th century. The responsible subject of criminal law today is a certain kind of citizen and a rational, choosing, self-determining moral agent. Obviously, it's a plausible story. Equally obviously, it's crude. In particular, it seems to me to fail to account for three things. First, it doesn't account for the fact that other ideas of responsibility, notably the idea of responsibility as founded not in capacity, but in character, which we find in philosophies as different as those of Spinoza and Hume, continue to have some resonance in criminal law. Second, therefore, it doesn't account for the fact that the capacity conception is only one among various interpretations of the Enlightenment tradition. Thirdly, and this is the crucial point, it fails to account for the fact that, as I'll try to show, the idea of subjective capacity responsibility comes to prominence in English legal thinking only in the 19th century and some way into it, and in English law a very great deal later than that. With these questions in mind, I undertook what I suppose we could call a pilot study to begin to trace the history of the general part of criminal law. I took three influential texts, all of them legal commentaries, but all written, at least in part, with an audience of lawyers and legislators in mind, and obviously drawn from different periods. I then compared their treatment of what we would today call the general part. The texts were William Blackstone's Commentaries on the Laws of England, published in the 1760s, James Fitzjames Stephen's History of Criminal Law and his Digest of Criminal Law, which is a sort of draft criminal code, from the 1880s, and Glanville Williams' influential Criminal Law, the General Part, first published in 1953. A structural as well as a content analysis of these three texts produced some gratifyingly striking contrasts. I can't tell you how relieved I was when I saw that there were these, I ploughed my way through this stuff. Most obviously, the idea of a general part is just missing from Blackstone. More significantly, it exists only in a very sketchy form in Stephen. While each of them spends only about 10% of their text considering rules applicable across offences, Williams's text, which provides the model for almost all subsequent commentaries and attempts at codification, almost exactly reverses the proportion. For both Blackstone and Stephen, it's the so-called special part, the criminal offences themselves, which are, as it were, where the theoretical action is. And their observations about general conditions of liability are very brief and are elaborated in relation to particular offences and defences. Now, that doesn't mean that either Blackstone's or Stephen's account lacks rationality, coherence, or system. Indeed, if we look at the ways they organise their material, it's very systematic and it tells us a great deal about how they saw their social world. Let me take just one example. For Blackstone, who was a great champion of the common law and who was writing just as legislation was set to become a really important force, the challenge was to present the law as rational and systematic, not in terms of the arcane procedural distinctions to which the common law was infamous, but rather of the interests it protected and the values it upheld. So Blackstone presented criminal law in a way which spoke to those concerns, grouping offences not in terms of procedural characteristics, as would have been the case with earlier commentaries, but in terms of substantive concerns adding up to a coherent sense of what he called public wrong. So we have offences against God and religion, offences against the king, offences against public order, person, property. And then he elaborated those in relation to exemplary fact situations which spoke to the important legal issues of his time. From the point of view of early 21st legal century legal philosophy, Blackstone's commentaries certainly do look a bit strange. But Blackstone's exemplary method of analysis makes a great deal of sense in its own terms. It's also curiously strongly resonant with Wittgenstein's description of language games. In a sense, Blackstone introduces us to the common law by trying to bring it alive as a practice or a way of life. He is, from the late 20th century perspective, spectacularly uninterested in the question, what makes it fair to hold an individual responsible for a crime? But this should hardly come as any surprise when we reflect on socio-political conditions and the demographics of crime in mid-18th century England. Well, I could multiply those contrasts, but for the purposes of the lecture, suffice it to say that these texts provide powerful evidence of a broad historical trajectory of conceptions of criminal responsibility. Individual responsibility is not a big issue for Blackstone, whose analysis in a way shows a deep confidence in the power of judge and jury to recognise criminal conduct when they see it. More significantly, that seems also to be true for Stephen. Certainly within Stephen's framework, two notable ideas absent from Blackstone's emerge. First, a vision of the human subject as a rational actor capable of being deterred by a systematic and well-publicised system of criminal law. Second, in his discussion of insanity, which is very extensive as compared with his discussion of any other responsibility issue, a concern with the lessons of which medicine and psychology imply about the limits of human responsibility. But only by the 50s has the question of individual, let alone subjective, responsibility as a question of individual fairness become the primary focus. Now, here's a speculative hypothesis about that. Wouldn't it suggest that the nature of the legitimation problems facing English criminal law was changing during this period? There would be two particular areas of interest. First, the changing relations between individual citizens and the nation state. In terms both of an increasingly democratic conception of citizenship and an expanding administrative terrain for the state, which means an expanding criminal law. Second, the growing influence of medical sciences on criminal law's understanding of human behaviour. The gradual emergence of the idea that a person's interior world could be an object of legal knowledge. Well, the pilot study was interesting, but of course it was very crude. So I was obviously going to have to go into a wide variety of texts and texts with with less time between them. I also needed to look more closely at the economic, social, and political context in which these intellectual texts were being produced. So I basically landed myself with an extremely unmanageable project. Not for the first time in my life, or the last, I suspect. Well, in pursuing it, I've had three really important pieces of luck. The first is to be working in an institution in which I can plunder ruthlessly the expertise of colleagues across a whole range of social sciences, so be warned. The second is that over the last decade, there's been a flourishing of literature on developments in the criminal process and punishment, which means I won't have to do much archival research in those fields. The third is that there are now several studies which do track rather closely the legal developments in the period, but which do so in what we might call monodisciplinary terms, hence in contrast to the interdisciplinary approach which I want to develop, or I should say multidisciplinary. So let me give you an idea of how these works have moved my project along by giving you a brief sketch of two very different stories. The first, which I'll call The Cultural Historian's Tale, can be represented by a fascinating book by Martin Wiener. It's called Reconstructing the Criminal. Wiener analyses a wide variety of sources, ranging from novels through newspapers, legal texts, official reports, and occasionally legislation and case law. He argues that there's a big change in ideas of responsibility through the 19th century. Early on, we have widespread anxiety about crime and a decisive reaction against the 18th century system of threatening very severe penalties, which were only irregularly enforced, and in which both judiciary and executive, therefore, had an enormous amount of discretion. In contrast, there emerges a powerful concern with uniformity in the administration of criminal law and a discourse of individual responsibility based on defective character. Now, in this vision, capacity was relevant, but not in the way it is today. It wasn't the capacity for understanding or control of the criminal act itself, but rather the capacity to work on one's character, which was the important thing. Furthermore, neither capacity in the sense of direct control of conduct nor capacity to work on character were regarded as objects of investigation at the criminal trial. They were not objects, as it were, of legal knowledge. Capacity was, in short, an operative assumption of the process rather than an object of legal inquiry. Criminal behaviour was seen as proceeding from uncivilized human nature, but through the announcement of a clear set of norms and the intervention of the modern prison, proper habits of self-governance could be instilled into a deviant but potentially malleable population. Interestingly, Wiener argues that this idea of character responsibility coincided within two completely different social philosophies, within a kind of moralised version of utilitarianism in which the incentive system was meant to make you a better person and hence more law-abiding, and within evangelicism where the threat of damnation in the next life was meant to have a similar effect. And there are quite a lot of resonances, as those of you who are interested in Michel Foucault will see, with Foucault's argument about moving from punishing the body to punishing the soul here. Now, to my mind, one of the interesting things about this early Victorian notion of responsibility is that it really didn't have any difficulty accommodating strict liability or negligence. The vast expansion of the so-called regulatory offences from the middle of the 19th century on, prompted largely by industrialisation and urbanisation, would have been seen as entirely consistent with individual responsibility. For responsibility wasn't based on capacity or self-control, but rather on the defendant's assumed character or role. So these new offences of strict liability, which are really the most striking development in English criminal law of the period, would have been seen as enforcing and constructing normative standards for potentially dangerous social roles, the responsible factory owner. But in the latter part of the century, Wiener argues, this odd equilibrium of utilitarianism and moralism starts to break down. And one of the prime things in the breakdown is the growing influence of the social and natural sciences, which gradually undermine confidence in the idea of individual responsibility. As it became more plausible to think that crime was, at least in some cases, the product of either social environment or physical pathology, the image of the criminal became less threatening, with many categories of offender increasingly seen as victims of incapacity of some kind, and hence as proper objects not of punishment, but of treatment or welfare-oriented paternalism. One of the ironies of this story is that the consequent weakening of the severity of criminal policy seems to have been facilitated precisely by the perceived success of the harsh early Victorian approach. With crime rates falling, fear of crime became less of an obstacle to penal moderation. Without making any further comment on Wiener's story, let me sketch for you another story of the same period, the legal historian's tale. This is exemplified by Keith Smith's Lawyers, Legislators and Theorists, a study of the development of English criminal jurisprudence from 1800 to 1957. Unlike Wiener, Smith focuses only on legal or directly legally relevant materials, cases, legislation, the reports of the criminal law commissions, and so on. The only thing he really goes beyond law with is Jeremy Bentham and John Austin, as you'll see in a moment. Austin, of course, himself was a law commissioner, though. Perhaps not surprisingly, Smith comes up with an entirely different story. According to him, what's happening in the 19th century is a gradual refinement of notions of responsibility based on individual will or capacity and traceable right through to the 18th century. He identifies, like Wiener, a strong reaction against the 18th century discretionary system and the decisive influence of utilitarian philosophy and the deterrence-based approach to criminal justice which it engenders. But unlike Wiener, Smith emphasizes that both Bentham and Austin insisted that, from the point of view of deterrence, there was a crucial difference to be drawn between intended and unintended, advertent or inadvertent behavior. The person who doesn't think about what she's doing is not deterrable in the same way that the advertent person is. This leads Smith to put enormous emphasis on the importance of the subjective, capacity-based responsibility which dominates today. Now, this thesis certainly has some power, but unfortunately, Smith tends to read his 19th century evidence through his 20th century lenses. He's far too conscientious a scholar to disguise the fact that the drift of criminal responsibility through the 19th century was far from being a linear one towards greater adoption of subjective principles, in fact, quite the reverse. But as a result of his focus on subjective responsibility, he fails to see a crucial point, and that is that for 19th century criminal lawyers, the subjective, objective, advertent, inadvertent distinction didn't have the same significance that it has for us today. The reason is the simple fact that throughout the 19th century, and indeed well into the 20th, English criminal law presumed a defendant to have intended the natural consequences of her actions. So the analytic basis for a distinction between subjective and objective mens rea was lacking. In the continued vigour of this presumption, one might argue that a significantly character-based approach to criminal responsibility outlived by many decades the locally based, relatively restricted criminal justice system in which it had its roots. Now, I've only had time to give you a very small flavour of those two stories. But let me just conclude by drawing out of them some of the hypotheses with which I'm now working. First, just a quick point about method. One of the fascinating things to me about these two books is that one could easily read them without realising that they're about the same subject. You can draw out common points like utilitarianism and the importance of medicine, but in most respects you could be reading about entirely different worlds. And this relates to a point I made earlier about the distinction between form and content. While Wiener's analysis is mainly focused on the substance of criminal policy, Smith's is directed to the conceptual form of liability. A focus in Smith which is so acute that the massive expansion in criminal law's scope during the century, along with the procedural changes which made that possible, more or less escape his comment. On another level, the merits and limitations of the two accounts are complementary. Wiener's book, despite its subtitle, Culture, Law and Policy, actually has remarkably little to say about developments in the criminal law. Conversely, Smith's legal focus enables him to identify, yet prevents him from exploring, a number of features of 19th century criminal law which would, had he noticed them, have been of obvious relevance to Wiener. It's a bit like that joke about the person who drops a coin in a dark street and goes to look for it under the light. Smith is looking under the light. Wiener, unfortunately, hasn't even noticed that he's lost the coin. So much for questions of method. Let me turn finally to the main hypothesis I'm working with. The hypothesis is premised not just on these two books and others like them, but on a wide range of work on the development of criminal procedure, which I haven't had time to discuss today. These include the emergence of, I'll just mention the most important points because they really are crucial to the story, the emergence of the adversarial system with its silencing of the defendant and its reinterpretation of the roles of judge and jury in the light of the increasing dominance of lawyers, the development of the law of evidence, the creation of a professional police force, the emerging role of expert witnesses, the growth of systematic law reporting, and the extraordinarily slow construction of a system of criminal appeals, which wasn't really in place until 1907. We might hypothesize that modern criminal law faces two rather general structural problems. The first is a problem about values. How are the substantive judgments which criminal law expresses to be legitimated? The second is a problem about knowledge. How is knowledge of the facts on which judgments in individual cases are based to be coordinated? So as this second problem, coordination, is concerned, at the end of the 18th century, English criminal law was still in some deep sense a process based on local knowledge. Both the structure of the pre-trial process, which was far more inquisitorial than today, and the jury trial itself exemplified a confidence in collective findings of fact and indeed recognition of wrongdoing. This was a world in which, as the American scholar George Fletcher puts it, crime was manifest, and when a manifestly criminal act was perceived, it made little sense to ask, was the person responsible for it? Rather, the boot was on the other foot. it was assumed that the person was responsible unless there was a special, widely recognised reason to displace that presumption. This explains the gradual elaboration of defences and of arguments for rebutting the inference of intended natural consequences as refinements to a system which relied heavily on character evidence to underpin the judgment of criminality made by juries. These juries, of course, no longer consisted of witnesses, as they had originally, but of evaluators of evidence. In a way, I'm talking here about a move from an exculpatory to an inculpatory system. And one thing to note about this system is that, in a way, factual and evaluative questions, questions of what I've called coordination and legitimation, simply weren't separate in the way that we think of them as being today. At the level of the problem of legitimation, while, as histories of crime and punishment in the 18th century show very vividly, there was a high level of social conflict, especially in the fields of property crime and public order, those responsible for the administration of criminal law had confidence in the strength of local arrangements and, failing that, in their own power ultimately to impose order and to negotiate conflicts as and when they arose. From the late 18th century on, the social conditions which sustained this equilibrium of coordination and legitimation were beginning to break down. With urbanisation, with greater social mobility, and the increase in democratic sentiments, both coordination and legitimation problems of criminal law changed. Political power still being markedly hierarchical and authoritarian, the immediate crisis was one of coordinating knowledge rather than imposing values. It's actually quite interesting in this respect that the very important procedural changes that I mentioned a moment ago, like the development of a professional police force and of summary courts to allow the criminal justice system to expand without sinking the economy, happened first in London. London has always been at the forefront of crime problems. And it still is. So the heavily moralised notion of individual responsibility noted by Wiener, I would argue, still expressed a deep confidence in the value judgment being made by criminal conviction. Conversely, its emphasis on deterrence, on publicity and uniformity of threat, attempted to address the problem of coordinating knowledge in an increasingly mobile society. If my reading of Stephen at the end of the century is right, the remarkable conclusion is that this breakdown is not yet complete at the end of the 19th century. In this context, the more or less undiminished importance of the presumption that a person intends the natural consequences of her acts has a dual significance. On the one hand, and particularly at the start of the century, it expressed a confidence in the propriety of substantive judgment, a lack of anxiety about legitimation. But gradually, it came to be seen as a way of solving the problem of coordinating knowledge, particularly once the growth of psychological notions of individual responsibility began to pose apparently intractable problems of proof for courts and juries. So, in short, a legal doctrine which found its roots in one social and procedural world survived because it made sense, albeit for different reasons, in another. Well, my research is still at an early stage, so my conclusions have to be tentative. Important questions remain to be answered about the increasing need to separate form from substance in criminal law, as values and processes diversify, as the substance of criminal law fragments as the system expands, and how this problem feeds into a deepening construction of mens rea or responsibility as a psychological question, as a question of fact. Questions too about the factors underlying the general trajectory in criminal law thinking from special to general part, from conduct through defences to to mens rea. There also remains an intriguing puzzle about why criminal law in England has proved so resistant relative to criminal procedure to rationalisation. It's very funny. Wiener's only argument as to why the criminal law never really got modernised was that lawyers were too conservative to put up with modernisation. Now, I mean, some of my prejudice is sort of sympathetic to that argument, but the truth is that the system of criminal procedure was radically modernised in the 19th century, and the lawyers simply had to put up with it. Actually, they won out of it, but that's another story. Another focus of my current research is about the persistence of the language of wickedness and malice in legal discourses of responsibility today, where this language coexists uncomfortably with the psychological discourse of subjective mens rea. None of these questions can, you'll be relieved to hear, be addressed this evening. What I do hope is to have illustrated the insights to be gained from constructing a dialogue between historical doctrinal criminal law scholarship and between scholarship on criminal law and on the criminal process. In doing so, I hope also to have sketched a conception of criminal law theory as an interpretive project which must draw not only on the standard resources of doctrinal analysis refined by philosophical argument, but also on the resources of history and, appropriately enough, in the LSE, the social sciences. Thank you.
Well, I think you can see from this lecture why Nicky is such an important addition to an already very distinguished department. We agreed that in the tradition of inaugural lectures that we wouldn't have a question time. And anyway, being questioned by Jeremy Paxman is enough for anyone for 1 week. But everyone here is invited to the reception, which I think is on the fifth floor of the old building. So thanks again for Nicky for the lecture. It's excellent. Brilliant lecture.